Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behind the badge.
It's Brian Noonan for Justin Kaufman on 720 WGN. The download continues. And I welcome author Chuck Klosterman. You have read Chuck's work in GQ, Esquire, The Washington Post, The Onion, just to name a few. He's the author of 9 books. His latest book, But What If We're Wrong, Thinking About the Present as If It Were the Past. Chuck, thanks for joining me. Good evening. We're doing now the way people are going to look at it in the future. You know, they're going to look back on what's happening in 2016 and make judgments about who we really are.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's true. That is the premise of the book. I mean, you know, in a way, it's sort of about, I mean, this kind of sounds pretentious, but it's kind of about the history of ideas. And the history of ideas is a history of people being wrong about stuff.
Right.
And that really is how it kind of unspools when we look back at both contemporary and deep history.
Well, because
there's a perception of what the world is like at the time it happened, and then it's the people who come later who decide to contextualize what it actually meant.
Well, you use the term casual certitude. So, we kind of think we know what's going on, and we're right, but we may not be right.
Well, I mean, to some degree, there's like a utility in that. It's weird. Politics and culture is flawed. You know, it's hard to operate in that way. We're almost forced to take on this casual certitude. But there's a problem with that. It's a real limiting way to kind of think about the experience of being alive. If you work from the premise that what we know now is somehow an accurate depiction of what we're actually experiencing.
And then as you take it further and you talk to a lot of different creative thinkers for the book, how can we change that to say, all right, how can we embrace thinking about the future, I mean, outside of just creating new things and ideas, cognizant of the fact that people will be looking back at us?
Well, you know, there's the principle of, you know, Occam's razor kind of that suggests whatever the most obvious solution is probably the accurate one. You always hear lawyers talk about this, cops, journalists, people who try to make decisions. They say, like, well, if we use Occam's razor, we're saying that whatever has the least amount of kind of unknown data is probably the best answer. But when you're going for deep history and when you're thinking about our life right now eventually being deep history, I feel you almost got to go the other way. You almost have to assume that anything that seems accurate is probably inherently flawed, and that you almost have to assume anything you can imagine might be wrong. Now, in a sense, that kind of makes things hopeless, right?
Yeah, I was going to say, how do you live like that where everything we're doing is wrong?
I think you accept it. That's kind of the idea about this. Like, I use examples through all these different idioms, basically saying that the way we view the world now almost certainly will not be the way the world is viewed in 100 or 300 or 1,000 years. As a consequence, a lot of people are like, well, make a prediction for me. What's something we're wrong about now that, you know, that will seem absurd? This is not a book of predictions, though. This is almost more of a book about different people talking about the way history works, and then sort of accepting that it almost tells people, like, to not be totally confident in your belief system as if somehow that we're the apex of mankind and the things that we believe are the final answers. We're probably just in the middle of the continuum.
Well, and a lot of the questions that you pose in the book to these people, they're pretty simple questions. How seriously should we view the content of our dreams?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's something I talk about because, you know, we've really moved away from the possibility that dreams are meaningful. You know, long ago there was this belief that, like, there were almost ways to, you know, project yourself into other realities. Then, you know, with Freud and Jung and the people in the early 20th century, it was like dreams are still important. We'll understand ourselves through our dreams. But across the 20th century, particularly by the time we get to the 50s and 60s, the idea becomes, well, dreams aren't really mean anything. It's like they're just electrical impulses in our mind. It's the leftover ideas. And we'll never really understand them. We'll never be able to really get inside someone's head and see what they're dreaming. So now we kind of concede that dreams are just meaningless. Mm-hmm. And yet a third of our lives are lived in these metaphysical worlds. So is it not possible that there will be a point when we will realize dreams actually were a very meaningful part about being alive?
So we need to just be open. As you said, we need to be open to the fact that, listen, what we know now may not be. You're not saying that we're living in a matrix.
Well, I mean,
or are we?
I'd say there's a 1 in 5 chance we're living in the matrix.
Okay. But, I like those odds.
You know, but the main thing, like, sometimes people talk to me about this book and they seem to think that this is like some kind of, I don't know, I'm making some kind of manifesto or making some big argument. This book ultimately is just sort of like, this is an interesting, entertaining way to think about life if you accept that what seems obvious is false. So I'm not really, you know, I'm not necessarily trying to change or persuade people
right.
to change. What I'm just saying is like, well, let's just look at these things like music and football and science and all these things, and let's just work from the premise that the fundamental things we believe about these things are false. What does that mean if these sort of galvanized, concrete ideas are just something we're temporarily dealing with and making up as we go?
Well, in the very simple analogy, you can think back to when everyone thought the world was flat, right? They had casual certitude back then, right? That their certitude.
Absolutely, but I mean, even a better example is like the idea of gravity.
Right.
Like Aristotle was the first person to really have a strong view on gravity. This is back when science was kind of intertwined with philosophy, and his idea was the reason a rock doesn't float is because a rock wants to be on the ground. A rock has agency. It desires to be at the center of the universe. Obviously, they believed Earth was the center of the universe.
Right.
So a rock is on the ground because it wants to get to the center of the Earth. Well, now, of course, that seems absurd. Yet we believed that for over 2,000 years. That was kind of the accepted view on gravity. Our current view of gravity really comes from the 1600s. So why would it be that this one thing that we believed for 2,000 years is idiotic, but the thing that we've believed for less than 500 years or less than 600 years or whatever somehow must be the right answer? In all likelihood, we're wrong, too.
Talking to Chuck Klosterman, the new book, But What If We're Wrong? Thinking About the Present as If It Were the Past. You can get it anywhere that fine books are sold. And you can go to ChuckKlostermanAuthor.com as well. All right, you made your bones, Chuck, writing about rock and roll. Everybody, you know, you're a great writer. You used to write for Spin. One of the questions in the book is what is going to be basically the defining memory of rock music 500 years from today? What did you and your thinkers come up with for that?
Well, yeah, what I did was I essentially thought about the idea of rock music receding from the culture, which seems to be happening,
yes.
And even if it's not happening, it's destined to happen. So eventually it will just be an academic pursuit in the same way we talk about music, you know, from the distant past in an academic setting in a college. Mm-hmm. So I tried to imagine a college classroom in, say, 500 years, and they were talking about rock music, and they were saying, you know, this was probably, along with television, the most important art form of the late 20th century, and yet everyone in the room will have no context for any of it. So they'll ultimately use one person, in all likelihood, as kind of a metaphor for the whole period, and the question becomes, who will that person
Ooh,
be?
Yeah.
In a rational world, the answer is the Beatles, but the world's not rational, so I had to go through other routes.
And where did you end up?
Well, I ultimately came up with the possibility that rock music might be remembered for just specific tropes and specific qualities. The idea that it's simple blues-based music,
uh-huh.
that it's very sexual music, that it's black music that was adopted by white people, that it kind of comes from the South, that there's an outlaw element to it. All of these things are things that we associate with rock music
sure.
and may last beyond our lives. So then which person fits those qualities best? Well, if you imagine these qualities as a suit, the suit is tailored for Chuck Berry. Chuck Berry, in many ways, is the idea of rock music. So it is possible to me that even though the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, Led Zeppelin probably have a more towering impact on the genre in this period, it could be Chuck Berry who's ultimately the one who's used as sort of shorthand for what rock music was.
Well, that is a very interesting take on that. And as you're describing all the elements that went into the suit, it does make sense. But I would have, if I had had to answer that question quickly, Chuck Berry would not have been the answer that I would have picked.
Well, neither did I. I had to write a book to come to that answer.
Well, see, you have time. You put in that kind of effort. I'm just like, I have no idea.
My book is kind of like a luxury. Like, I have the luxury of being able to sit around for a year thinking about how things will be remembered by people who have not yet been born. The average person can't do that. They just got to work. However, they can buy this book and do it for 4 hours.
But what if we're wrong thinking about the president as if it were the past? See, yes, I have 4 hours. I don't have a year to ponder the deep questions of the world. But all right, since you mentioned TV in your musical answer, that's another one of the thoughts. Should we be worried about the content of what's on TV now we're thinking about people in the future looking back at us?
My thing about television is that, you know, when we watch it in the present tense, we're interested in things like entertainment value. How good is the acting? How formally inventive is it? All of these things that are really based around the experience of watching something that's supposed to be reflecting society now. But in the distant future, particularly if television kind of disappears, what will be the reason someone in 250 years, we'll want to go back and go through all this footage we have. Yeah. What it will be to see what is the best reflection of what life actually was like. So things like entertainment value and acting and all that stuff, they won't care about that. What they'll be looking for is something I call ancillary verisimilitude, which are things that are accidentally in the show that make it feel real. And the conclusion I come to is that it's probably a show like Roseanne, where they were making a show just to be entertaining, but they did all these things without knowing it. You know, they cast people who were overweight, which actually is a reflection on kind of how America is.
Right.
It reflected people who, you know, the conversations on that show would happen like in the kitchen and the laundry room, all these places that actually are closer to what conversation is like in life.
Right. They weren't rich and beautiful. Yeah. They were just regular folks.
Yeah, and if the intention of the show had been like, we want to show poverty, it wouldn't have worked. But I think what they thought they were doing is just making an interesting show and accidentally sort of, imbuing it with all this truth.
And as you're saying that does represent most of us. Because I'm looking, you know, Dynasty, that doesn't represent what the country was like in the 80s. You know, the shows that are on now, they don't really represent things. You got to have those kind of sitcoms where it's real life.
Say like a real high-end show like The Wire, okay?
Right.
The Wire is a much more sophisticated show than Roseanne, but there's a real sort of political consciousness with it. There are biases built in. The Wire is supposed to mean something. So when people in the future watch this, when they go back 100 years from now and watch The Wire, they'll be like, whoa, this is what David Simon was trying to say, okay? When you watch Roseanne, you won't get that sense.
Right.
You don't get the sense there's any political nature to it. It became more of a feminist show as it moved on. But a lot of the real sort of interesting things about it were just thrown into the show because they were like, well, this is something we're not real concerned about. It's secondary to what we're doing.
Yeah. And as you said, they were very reflective of how people really are. All right, one last thing from the book, and it has to do with something that most of the country is fixated with, whether it's high school football, college basketball, now the NFL is starting up, sports. And you posit the question in the book, is there a chance that sports will be extinct? And, you know, we already see that starting to happen at lower levels with concussions in football, so a lot more kids aren't playing and things are starting to dwindle away in small amounts. Do you think sports as we know them will cease to exist?
Well, this would take a long time, but the thing that I'm talking about is the extinction of team sports. There'll always be individual sports because people will care about health.
Right.
But a lot of the things that were the direction we're moving as a society, the things that we like, you know, the idea of screaming at a kid to get results, or that intimidation is like a valuable thing, or that the masculinity is prioritized. These are all things that are like inherent to team sports, and they're hard to get away from those things. So it seems as though some of the core aspects of team sports runs counter to the trajectory of our society as a whole. And I wonder if some of the issues people are having with football, if that's just the beginning. And that football might be the first sport to disappear, but they're all going to go. Because maybe we're moving in a direction that moves us away from sort of admiring the qualities that are necessary to succeed in team sports.
Interesting. Now, what about, If you were thinking about people 500 years from now, and they look back now, what would they think about our politics in general and this particular election season in particular?
Well, I mean, one of two things will happen. I mean, if I think the most likely scenario is that Clinton will probably win in a landslide, and Trump and, to a lesser extent, Sarah Palin in the previous election will be seen as sort of this Hail Mary pass by the Republican Party where they were kind of out of ideas, losing their demographic, and trying these radical things, and this will be remembered sort of as the end of the GOP. Or Trump will win, and it will be this shocking thing that will just continue to shock people, right. And it will indicate that what really mattered about this time period was not the economy and all of these things, but it was all identity politics, and that's what people really cared about the most. Doesn't seem that way or didn't seem that way 2 years ago. It's starting to feel that way now. And if Trump were to succeed, that's what it would mean to people in the future.
Yeah. So it is the message that we will leave. Tell people who haven't read it real quick about the ethicist column in the New York Times Magazine.
Well, I don't do that anymore, but I was the ethicist for 3 years. There was this column. I mean, I hated when people described it like this, but I'm going to describe it this way now. It was a little bit like Ann Landers, except the problems were about ethics.
Okay.
People would write in about problems in their lives, and then I would try to sort of say, like, well, you can do what you want, but here would be the most ethical response in that scenario.
Ah, very nice. And you now you're focused on the deep thinking of what will people in the future think of us now. How do you shake that when you're done writing the book? Are you constantly consumed? Do you lay awake at night going, oh, what are they going to think about us in 500 years?
No. I mean, I just have the benefit of being a weird person.
No, there's nothing wrong with that. If we had more time, I would want, speaking of something that I found unusual, I wanted to go back and talk to you about I Wear the Black Hat, where you talk about villainy and why it's important for us to label people as bad. And that's another fascinating subject that we'll have to talk about another time. Chuck, I really appreciate the time. Again, the book is But What If We're Wrong? Thinking About the Present as If It Were the Past. You can buy that anywhere the books are sold. Go to ChuckKlostermanAuthor.com or visit Chuck on Facebook, Chuck Klosterman Official. Chuck, thanks for the time tonight. Great read. I appreciate it.
You got it.
Take care. That's Chuck Klosterman. You can pick up the book. It does make you think, which is always good. I know sometimes it's fun not to think and just let things wash over us, but sometimes it's very good to think.